From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lawn workers, military logistics experts, and nuclear research scientists, they're all federal government jobs, and they are all now jobs on the line. President Bush said he would put half of all federal jobs up for competitive bidding when he was on the Republican convention stage back in Philadelphia. He wasn't kidding. As of last week, it was announced that 850,000 federal jobs would be put up for bid, including bids from private contractors, beginning in the next 30 days. The White House says it's the path to shrinking bureaucracy and delivering market-driven value to taxpayers. Labor says Bush is skewering them again for opposing him at election time. Cynics see a gravy train of fat deals for friends of George coming around the bend. We're looking tonight at and through the politics and principles of privatization. Will it work? Who wins and who loses when open bidding hits the vast federal bureaucracy? Is this the real Bush revolution? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight with Jason Peckinpah, reporter for The Government Executive, a monthly magazine covering operations of the federal government. He's been watching the story unfold in Washington. Good evening and welcome, Jason Peckinpah.
Yes, good evening.
Great to have you. We're also joined tonight by Paul Light, Douglas Dillon Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Paul Light.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Jason Peckinpah, take us into the undergrowth here. This is a very big number, 850,000. There are some details, though, in the announcement. I guess it amounts to almost half of the federal workforce. Exactly what's going to transpire here, or what's supposed to?
Well, that's right, it is an unprecedented figure, that 850,000. Essentially, last Friday, the White House put out a draft regulation saying that it would let private firms, private contractors, compete for the jobs of 850,000 federal employees. So we're talking about basically half of the entire civilian workforce, you know, being on the line over the next several years.
And when you say civilian workforce, there are more employees that are military, is that right?
That's right. And this is primarily targeted at civilian employees.
What kinds of jobs are going to be put up for bid, including bids from private contractors? We've heard a lot about lawnmowers and dishwashers. What's the full spectrum?
Right. Well, the Bush administration they prefer talking about kind of the low end, if you will, the lawn mowing type positions. But it goes beyond that. It includes accounting jobs, legal service type jobs. It includes forest rangers, park service employees, the sort of people who I think most Americans, you know, associate with the government. You know, you go to a national park, mm-hmm. you see a ranger. Folks like that, they conceivably could be on the line with this.
And how is this program supposed to be rolled out? How many should be put up for bid? By what time?
Right. Well, it's already started. In fact, it kind of got underway back in March 2001 with some guidance from the Office of Management and Budget.
Mm-hmm.
Agencies are supposed to compete about 127,000 jobs by next October. That was kind of the
first
deadline
tranche.
That was set.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And after that, the target is 425,000 jobs. They haven't put a precise timeline on that, but I think about 2 to 3 years they'd like to see that be done.
You keep in touch with the people who work for the federal government. Is this sending shockwaves through that very large world, or was this fully expected from the Bush administration?
I think it was expected to a degree, but and this is something Dr. Light can talk about too. There's always a certain skepticism within the bureaucracy as to whether or not the administration really intends to follow through on these promises. I mean, the Clinton administration tried to keep the size of government down too, and I think especially last year, most agencies just were trying to wait out the Bush administration, but now they see that they're really serious about this.
Paul Light, jump in here. Speak to the scale of these proposed potential transfers of jobs to the private sector. Is this epical?
It's big. It's big time, to take a phrase from the vice president.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very significant effort. It is a very awkward effort in the sense that there's really not a clear plan for how to do it. The Bush administration is committed to moving jobs into a competitive stance. It's possible that federal employees can win some, even many of these competitions, but I think there's a concern among federal employees that the underlying rules change is creating a very clear bias in favor of getting these jobs into the private sector.
So to be clear here, federal agencies will have their own opportunity to be part of the bidding process. They're not cut out of it. It won't necessarily go private, but they'll have to go up against private bidders.
In theory, that's true, but there is in the new rules being proposed an option for departments and agencies to simply convert jobs when they see a reasonable possibility that you can have extra value and savings in the private sector. At the end of the day, these contractors, if we do move these jobs out, will be federal employees of a kind. They won't be as responsible to or accountable to political leadership. They'll be under contracts of one kind or another, but they'll be with us for a good long time. It's a quasi-permanent workforce that we're talking about here.
Why do you say that? Won't these jobs, once they're put up for bid, won't the bid come around again regularly?
Well, in theory it will, but once you deforest a workforce of its capacity to compete.
You mean the federal workforce?
Once the federal workforce gets out of a business, it's very difficult to get back in.
But if my lawn company gets the job for the VA hospital down the street for the next 3 years,
correct,
presumably somebody else can come in and compete with me for the 3 years after that.
Right, but as Jason Peckinpah is saying, you know, that's really at the low end of the competition. At the higher end of the competition, what we've seen in state and local government is that there's often only one bidder for the job. Sometimes what you get is that the bidder will win with a low bid and then increase prices over time, and eventually what you'll have is a situation where the government is virtually dependent on a single contractor because that contractor now has the institutional memory.
Sounds like a coral reef growing around the government here. Paul Light, to take us into the arguments here, the White House presents this as driving toward efficiency and reduced costs. Critics, including Paul Krugman in the New York Times yesterday, said this is a giant scam. This is going to create a huge spoils system for the party in power.
Well, I think it's an overstatement to say it's a spoils system. I do think that there's some concern here, some real reason for concern about whether this kind of outsourcing activity or competitive sourcing, as it's called, is going to be done wisely. It's one thing to sit down and say, look, what jobs do we need to keep in the federal government? What jobs can be better performed by the private sector at better value? It's quite another to basically say, look, you've got to get 425,000 jobs competed within 1 or 2 years. That is an unprecedented challenge. It's very difficult to do, and it's going to lead departments and agencies to take shortcuts of one kind or another. And at the end of the day, this is not privatization.
Why not exactly again?
This is contracting out. These people will be paid by the federal government to perform jobs that were in government. It's not completely cleaving off a function and basically saying, let the private sector do it, give the private sector the revenue sources. We're going to have a quasi-permanent contract workforce that will labor on behalf of the federal government under contract. That is not pure privatization as the experts would define it.
Jason Peckinpah, between the enormous institutional restructuring going on with the Homeland Security bill and this initiative, we've got a hurricane of change going on in the federal government.
Yeah, in many ways, it's unprecedented, at least over the past 20 years. And one important point is that the agencies moving to the Homeland Security Department are not exempt from this competitive sourcing initiative. They still have to hold these job competitions, although they might get a few breaks on the schedule. But it is a difficult process for agencies to run, especially, I might add, the civilian agencies who don't have much of a track record for holding these job competitions. Over the past 6 to 7 years, it's really just been the Defense Department that did held these kind of competitions. And for most civilian agencies, it's an entirely new thing. They're starting from scratch.
What are you hearing in Washington? Are people girding to step up to this? I mean, the order's coming down. It has to be done, right?
That's right, yeah. And you know, OMB has been, you know, somewhat flexible. It has said that some agencies can come in below the 15% target. That was at 127,000 overall figure I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So they
the
have
first
been,
round.
That's right, the first round. Some agencies don't. They can come in under if need be. But, you know, at this point, most agencies have set up offices. They've assigned officials. You know, many competitions are already underway. There's been estimates that about 20 to 40,000 employees are already part of competitions right now.
Paul Light, how do you see this ultimately affecting the profile, the efficiency, the effectiveness of the federal government?
It could be helpful. It could be damaging. I mean, it depends in part on how it's done and whether it's done in a hostile voice. I think what's happened over the last couple of weeks is that we've had a very bitter conclusion to the Homeland Security debate, labor management argument. We've had Democrats and Republicans fighting with each other. And, you know, it's created a tense moment. Right after you agree on a Homeland Security compromise, you have a release of an outsourcing initiative that's really going to change the shape of the federal government. And I think federal employees are nervous. I don't think there's going to be a mass exodus of employees, but I do think there's considerable tension in the federal workforce, and it's worrisome.
We've heard a lot in recent months as the economy's been bad about how, oh boy, are you lucky if you've got a federal job. But that no longer looks like quite such a rock-solid position to be in.
Well, I think you're still lucky if you've got a federal job. There aren't many destinations out there in the economy right now that aren't hurting. And I think many of the employees who are in these competitions are intensely dedicated to the mission. You look at the employees in the Homeland Security Department, where there has been this bitter dispute. But at the end of the day, as Tom Ridge was saying this morning, the likely Secretary of Homeland Security, the vast majority of federal employees are committed to doing their jobs and to doing them well. I think they're unsettled by the conversation underway about outsourcing. I think they're unsettled by the level of vitriol that surrounded the Homeland Security debate. But it's still a good place to work.
And Jason Peckinpah, what's the power shift that comes in Washington as these changes transpire? Certainly unions are a big loser. Is there a party face to the power shift as well?
To a degree. I mean, Republicans have supported, you know, privatization in general, you know, for quite a while. Although, you know, it's also a regional thing. Obviously, Washington, D.C. area representatives all strongly oppose this plan. You know, folks that representatives that have Army bases in their districts, you know, adamantly oppose this. So I think in general it tilts Republican, but it often breaks down to just, you know, do you have federal employees living in your district?
And Paul Light, we've heard for years, certainly since the Reagan era, about the federal government as a kind of big target of cost cutters, of critics of inefficiency and sloth and laziness and all the rest. After years of that kind of critique and some action on it, is it still a fair characterization? Is there an opportunity here to move to a much more efficient service-providing government?
Well, I think that the federal government's gotten better over the last 10 years. It's more service-oriented. Social Security Administration's faster on the phones. We've had significant improvements under both Democrats and Republicans in performance. We've got a terribly outmoded civil service system that really is indefensible and needs to be changed. And we need to be clearer about the mission of the agencies of the federal government and get rid of some that don't have a mission any longer. But, you know, politicians of both parties often come into office arguing that we need to cut the size of government. That's well and good, but if you just move the job into the private sector and it's still a quasi-government job, you really haven't done anything but play a shell game.
And what kind of cost savings might actually be there?
You know, there's just really not very good evidence on this. There is some evidence at the state and local level. A lot of it's anecdotal. People talk about possible cost savings up to 30%. People talk about the possibility that there'll be added efficiency. But you know what? We contract out millions of jobs a year as it is, and we really don't know much about whether we're getting fair value for those contracts. We think we are, but this is really a field that's rife with hunch and rife with ideology on both sides of the equation, and there's not a lot of facts out there on how contracting out saves or doesn't save money.
We've just got a few seconds left. Do you see cost savings, efficiency, or ideology as the primary mover here?
I see the 2004 election looming. I don't think that George Bush wants to be the president who goes into an election having increased the size of government. And right now, the federal workforce is growing. It's getting larger every day with Homeland Security. I don't think Bush wants to run against Al Gore again, having Gore claiming that he's the president of smaller government and Bush being the president of larger government. I think that undergirds at some level
what's going on here.
Yep.
But as you say, they're still going to be working for the government one way or another. Paul Light, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Paul Light is a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. We're talking tonight about taking the U.S. government private, about opening the federal bureaucracy to market competition on a grand scale. Who benefits when the federal government goes private? All of us? A few of us? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about taking the U.S. government private on a grand scale, about opening the federal bureaucracy to market competition. The White House announced last week 850,000 federal jobs will be opened to competitive bid from the private sector. That is nearly half of the federal civilian workforce. What do you think? Is it high time the keen blade of the market cut through the federal bureaucracy? Or is this politically driven, ideologically driven, with little real gain? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Jason Peckinpah. He's a reporter for the Government Executive in Washington, D.C. We're joined now from Los Angeles by Adrian Moore. He's vice president of the research at the Reason Foundation. Good evening and welcome, Adrian Moore.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And from Tacoma Park, Maryland, we're joined tonight by Jackie Simon. She's public policy director for the American Federation of Government Employees. Good evening and welcome, Jackie Simon.
Good evening and thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Jackie Simon, the unions that surround federal employees have really been taking it on the chin. It looks like you're going down for the count here. You're looking in line to lose some really big numbers.
Well, don't count us out yet, but you're right. The Bush administration is clearly at war against its own workforce. If they're not taking away our civil service protections or busting our unions, they're trying to privatize our jobs.
But why shouldn't they? We've been hearing for years that these are not jobs that are done efficiently, that there are cost savings to be had here, that the cool, clear breeze of the market will make things better. What's wrong with that view?
Well, I can respond to what's wrong with that view, but I think it's really important to recognize that the current administration is pursuing a policy that is not at all about saving money. It's about moving money. It's about moving money away from the public sector into the hands of contractors who are politically well-connected.
Well, if it's bidding, how does it end up in the hands of well-connected contractors?
Well,
doesn't the low bid win?
Well, up until last Thursday, that was true when there was a competition between the public sector and the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
What happened last Thursday was that the Bush administration issued preliminary new regulations that allow agencies to award contracts now to whomever they want without regard to the cost. So it's no longer about low cost. Agency officials are now given broad discretion, remember that word, flexibility, to award the contracts to whomever they'd like to award them to.
Jason Peckinpah, jump in with us here. Is that technically totally true that the contracts go to whoever they want to give them to?
Well, in a sense, yes. I mean, the new process that Jackie's referring to, known as the best value process, essentially allows the agencies to consider factors besides cost when they decide who wins these competitions. So they can look at a company's past performance, for instance. They can take that into consideration. However, they can still also decide a competition on the basis of low bid as well. That isn't being taken away. It's just there's basically a new option that agencies have under this new regulation.
Adrian Moore, join us. Your foundation has been very big on outsourcing. When you look at the outlines of the new order, are you confident that this is going to bring efficiency, even with the kind of discretion that's allowed in this movement?
Well, there's a theme here that people have to remember that privatization is just a policy tool. It's not a magic pixie dust or some kind of switch you just flip and you create efficiency. It's a process and a means of using competition to get certain ends. If you do it ineptly, you're not going to get those results. If you do it competently, you will get those results. And we've been doing research on privatization for about 25 years, and there's vast piles of studies that have been done on the outcomes of privatization, and it all reaches pretty much the same conclusion that when you do it right, you get results. You get cost savings if you want cost savings. You get service improvements if you want service improvements. It's all in how you do it. And
so in what percentage, in your research, Adrian Moore, what percentage of government privatization has been done right, has achieved better service or lower cost?
Well, That there's no firm number on that because we
well,
have
but
a
give us a sense. Is it the rare thing when it works well, or is
no,
it fairly
not
common?
Not at all. It's the rare thing actually mm-hmm. when it goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, you know, if you go back to the late 70s when privatization was getting started, probably things went wrong more often, even though they were privatizing then very simple things, mm-hmm. grass cutting, trash collection. Now we're privatizing space shuttle operations, prisons, and things like this,
mm-hmm.
much more complicated stuff because we've gotten better at it. And now you get something like about 7% of privatizations wind up getting terminated or reversed on average each year because they go bad. So it's 93% success rate.
Well,
may I comment on that?
Sure, Jackie Simon, jump in.
I think there's two points to make. First of all, you know, I'm not sure what studies he's referring to, but the fact of the matter is, with regard to studies in the federal government by independent agencies, the Government Accounting Office, which is a research arm of Congress, and the Defense Department, which has done the most outsourcing in the federal government, mm-hmm. its own IG internal audits, have never shown once any concrete cost savings. All they ever can produce, and I heard Paul Light saying this earlier on the show, is projections of savings. But there are no documented cost savings from privatization in the federal government, despite decades, as the other guest suggests.
Adrian Moore, I don't want to get lost in the research record here, but you hear Jackie Simon's allegation. She's saying the proof just isn't there.
It's just not true. There's lots of research that shows cost savings has been realized. In fact, the Center for Naval Analysis, which is an independent research body, did a great study last year looking at very long-term privatizations, going back 10 years and more, and with lots of data, and found sustained savings over time of around 25% on average.
I want to mark that for the moment as an area of important disagreement. But Adrian Moore, let me put this to you. If this movement goes ahead, as outlined by George Bush, and if it works, as you would suggest, 93% of the time or something close to that, what's the payoff for the American public? And I guess maybe what are the costs?
Well, the payoff goes back to what Jason was talking about with best value. And the process of privatization has really shifted to how can we get the best deal for the customers, being generally the taxpayers, the people who use these services. When we just did privatization by low bid, that's great when you're doing something very simple, mm-hmm. again, trash collection, building maintenance, and so on. When you're doing complex things, information technology, social service delivery, space shuttle operations, there you want, you know, something, a much more complicated set of criteria. And if someone can offer you a much better job for the same price you're paying to do it in-house, that can still be a very good deal, even if you don't outright save money.
And what about the skepticism on the political front? The Miami Herald looked into privatization in Florida, done by the president's brother, Jeb Bush, and reported that the experiment has been a success, at least for him and the Republican Party. They said the policy has spawned a network of contractors who have given him, Jeb Bush, other Republican politicians and the Florida GOP millions of dollars in campaign donations. What keeps best value from tipping over into payola?
Well, two things. First of all, there's clearly examples of that. I mean, corruption is a problem, and checks and balances are necessary. One of the things that the Bush program does is try to put those checks and balances in place. Keep in mind, though, that money that's given by those private contractors is a drop in the bucket to the money that the unions are pumping in to the political process in Florida. The private sector has never come close to competing with the unions in the privatization industry has never come close to matching the unions in terms of the money put into campaigns.
Jackie Simon, I'm going to let you respond to that, but I want to bring some of our callers in first. There are so many who want to join this conversation. Josh.
You have to let me respond to that.
All right. Have at it.
In the last election round, the unions were outspent 22 to 1.
By
businesses.
All right, which would be a slightly different definition from private contractors at the government till.
No, I think that's a distinction without a difference. If you look at the list of contributors to the Republican Party and Republican candidates, and you look at the corporations who have benefited from those contributions directly by gaining contracts, I don't think you're going to find a huge amount of deviation. Maybe it was an accident that the Homeland Security bill suddenly had several million dollars, actually tens of millions of dollars of giveaway to Eli Lilly, former employer of Mitch Daniels, the director of the Office of Management and Budget.
And maybe it wasn't. We've got your point. I do want to bring our callers in. Josh is calling from Whitewater, Wisconsin. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say that the classic problem you have when you start bringing in competitiveness mm-hmm. is the government, if you call them their own company, doing their own work, and now bringing in a different company under them, with them still overseeing it, is that the work doesn't necessarily get done in the same manner that they're used to doing it, as long as the guidelines are there for the end product to end up the same, that the job ends up the same in the end. But I think there's going to be, especially with this number of jobs, a problem with the government overseeing how the work's being done and not agreeing with how it's being done necessarily with the – I don't see the guidelines being in place as to – you can't tell the company that you bring in
keeping strict
exactly
oversight.
How to do it.
So we see the room for foul-ups, Josh, but where does that leave you? Are you in favor of bringing in this market force anyway or not?
Well, listening to the debate, I think it's still one way or the other. I think it needs to be done once to see whether we have savings or not necessarily money, but if it's done faster and at least the same, at least as well as it's being done now.
So let's tiptoe in here. Josh, thanks for your call. I think we've got it. Jason Peckinpah, I want to put this to you. What's the level of confidence that you're picking up in the federal government that the guidelines for overseeing work that's contracted out are going to be rigorous enough that the work will be done well?
Well, that's a crucial issue. And I mean, you know, Josh raises a very, very important thing that I think, you know, in the long run will really determine whether this initiative succeeds or not. I mean, if you look at the Energy Department, in 2001, they said they had 14,700 employees.
Mm-hmm.
They had over 100,000 contractor employees. So basically, they have this huge contractor workforce, which is being managed and overseen by a very small in-house federal workforce. The question is there, will there be the capacity left in federal agencies to oversee all of these contractors? That's an issue that the Bush administration hasn't spent much time yet, at least publicly. And it's really something that remains to be seen, just how these contracts will be managed.
But we're off to the races anyway. Josh, thanks for your call. Jackie Simon, please.
Okay. You know, Josh's question raises for us some especially frustrating situations that members of my union have faced.
Such as?
Places like Fort Rucker, Warner Robins Air Force Base, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
What's happened?
Fort Knox. Time and again, contractors will bid on work, and they'll come in with a low bid under
mm-hmm.
the old rules,
mm-hmm.
and immediately realize that they're incapable of performing the work. Certainly, they can't hit the ground running, and the government has just let go its entire in-house workforce that had experience and actually knew how to do the work.
And it's hard to get it back.
And once they're there, the contractor comes in and realizes, oh my goodness, we didn't realize the scope of work was this large, and we're going to have to modify our contract. And the Fort Knox one was, within a week, modifying the contract so that it was no longer the lowest price. But then the government had to detail federal employees from other Air Force bases from around the country to come in and train the contractor workforce.
So that raises the question.
That this is just transition costs, but they're duplicative costs. And then you've got the whole question of okay, we as taxpayers, if we're looking at this from a cost perspective, we as taxpayers have invested a tremendous amount in the training and experience of the federal workforce, and we're willing to throw that out the window to replace them with a lower paid, inexperienced workforce that we're eventually going to have to pay the cost for training again, because either way. Taxpayers end up paying.
Jackie, you're triggering a lot of questions in my mind, but I want to get callers in here. John's mm-hmm. calling from Clarendon, Pennsylvania. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Thank you for letting me on.
Good to have you.
Yeah, I'm a former NASA employee. I've worked there 32 years.
All right.
And they've privatized many, many, many jobs. the key thing is the lady was just saying, is don't dumb down your civil service workforce. For example, all the Hubble Space Telescope flight operations are handled out of Johns Hopkins.
Okay.
The Chandra X-ray telescope.
That is, they've been privatized to the university.
They've been privatized, yeah. The Chandra, you know, that you just heard the news yesterday about the two black holes approaching each other.
Right.
That's managed out of Harvard. Now, that's the flight operations. But those flight operations were initially overseen by skilled NASA scientists and managers.
Are you saying they've been dumbed down at Johns Hopkins and Harvard?
No. I'm saying the key to going to privatization is don't dumb down your civil service workforce.
Do you see a real risk of that, John?
Well, NASA has a unique, I think, position. Where I worked at Goddard Space Flight Center, the way they avoided this was to have an in-house spacecraft development at all times. So then you were training new, the older employees were training the new employees as how you design, build, test, launch, and operate a spacecraft. And with those skills, they had skills to oversee their contractors. You know, so that's one thing. You've got to keep a skilled workforce in place in the government, and that was that's the way the Goddard Space Flight Center does it. Now,
can you really replicate that NASA example across the whole vastness of the federal government with duplicative systems?
I
think each agency has to do it. But let me give you another dimension. In terms of our human resources, in terms of our career development, that was privatized, and we had a psychologist who was actually under contract with the National Football League.
Okay.
She's a very skilled person, and we would never have had access to that type of expertise in the government. You know, and then let me give you another example in terms of cost savings.
So that was an advantage for you.
Pardon?
So that was an advantage of privatizing something.
We had access to an expert working outside in the field.
We'll have touchdowns on the moon.
Working there 30 years, what do they know? The other problem, in terms of cost savings, when you're running spacecraft through test facilities, they may be very busy. But then when the workload drops, if you have a bunch of civil servants, they're sitting there. But in the terms at Goddard, the company would lay off employees or transfer their employees to operations elsewhere in the company, but not charge NASA.
So there's an advantage, and we see it.
Operations have been privatized. Now,
John, that's a good nuanced picture. We're running out of time before the break. I want to thank you for sharing it with us. It's terrific. Adrian Moore, how about it? How do we keep from dumbing down as we go for low bid, even for best value? How do you feel confident, especially in the hands of a government that is, by ideology, not friendly to government itself? Might it be happy to see it dumbed down, maybe go away a little bit?
Well, I agree that the one thing that's missing from the Bush proposal so far is where exactly that investment in the human resources to manage these things is going to come from. And we know from the history of privatization in this country that that's crucial. If you're going to do it, you've got to have the people still in the organization and the people in place to deal with the decisions that still have to be made in-house. But keep in mind a couple of things here. One is that the story the gentleman just told about access to the personnel via privatization, I mean, that's crucial. You're getting more flexibility in the mix of people that you're using. Part of the reason why you have to invest so heavily within government in making sure you keep the right people around is you don't have the flexibility to bring them on when you need them or move them to other jobs when you don't need them. So when they're not actually being used on their specific job, they tend to just sit around.
So that's a good thing, but the world is changing. Adrian Moore, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Jackie Simon, Jason Peckinpah, hang with us. We're talking tonight about taking the U.S. government private on a grand scale, about opening the federal bureaucracy to market competition. What do you think? Should we pity federal workers? Or is it high time they felt the market reality most of America lives with? Do you care if the lawn man at the Smithsonian is a public or private employee? What about the AIDS researcher? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
WBUR.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about taking the U.S. government private. The Bush administration has launched a program to do that on a grand scale, to open the federal bureaucracy to market competition. I'm joined tonight by Jason Peckinpah, a reporter for the government executive in Washington, D.C., from the Reason Foundation in Los Angeles by Adrian Moore, and from the American Federation of Government Employees, Jackie Simon, in Tacoma Park, Maryland. You can join us as well. If federal employees lose ground, lose pay, lose benefits, does all American labor lose ground? And is this the pathway to efficiency or to sweetheart deals for the politically well-connected? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
I'm actually Steve Grundman. I was the Deputy Undersecretary for Industrial Affairs and Installations in the second Clinton administration.
Great. Good to have you, Steve.
And had a lot to do with not even the early days of this, but I think I'd call it the middle days of privatization. I thought I could offer a couple observations on the conversation that's been ongoing.
What's catching your ear?
The first one is that the principle of the idea that's been enunciated here by this administration is sound. There is plenty of very solid statistics. Suffice it to say, Jason is right on that, and I do think Paul Light, as high a regard as I have for him, was wrong.
So here's a Clinton man saying, go for it.
The second point is just that, is that this, it is actually a little bit disconcerting for me and I think for others of us in the last administration who worked so hard, in fact, to get this program off the ground and, in fact, to reform the process, to see the new administration stepping in and co-opting it. Now, I will say there is one important distinction that our administration, given our ambivalence about the issue in some respects, was not able to do, and that is to break this so-called A76, the process. And this has been alluded to in the conversation.
And what's the heart of that issue?
It is changing the process by which these privatizations are done, and in particular, calling out best value as the metric by which to judge them.
Do you favor this best value metric, or is this a loophole?
I do favor it. There was a bit of a rear guard action in this direction out of the Pentagon in the last administration, but again, it has to be said, my very own party is a bit ambivalent, or was at least in that administration, on this issue, and we were never able quite to reform the process as this new administration has now suggested it would do.
Steve, stand by. I want to get Jackie Simon to respond to this. Jackie, Steve was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Installation Management in the Clinton administration. He says this is just a continuation of what was put up and running under that Democratic White House. Do you see a difference here?
Well, I think that he's absolutely right. The Clinton administration certainly laid the groundwork for all of this, and they certainly pursued outsourcing with a vengeance. But the Clinton administration, which by anybody's standard was certainly very pro-contractor, couldn't bring itself to favor or even allow a pilot project with this best value. I do want to say one thing, and that is, we keep saying that this initiative is about putting the federal bureaucracy and opening it to competition. One thing that really has to be part of this discussion is the fact that competition is really for federal employees only. Once the work is contracted out, there's never another public-private competition.
I mean, it's a one-time competition.
Once the work is contracted out, unless the firm engages in egregious conduct, criminal conduct, or fails absolutely miserably, that contractor can expect to keep that work.
They will be competing ultimately with other contractors, won't they?
No, they won't. Renewals. They will have periodic renewals, but they will not. The contract is almost never subject to repeated competition, and literally, not virtually, but literally, never subjected again to a public-private competition.
It's a great point about the one-way street. Steve, our good caller, let me put that to you. Did you see this as a one-way street? And once a contractor's got it, she's got it for life.
I think it comes to the only last point that I wanted to make, and that is, this initiative under any administration will fail if we do it wrong, and I think it has a large prospect of success if we do it right. Mm-hmm. And the key thing to doing it right is the one thing that I think does divide the Republican Party's approach to this and my administration's approach to this, and that is respecting the fact, and I think Jason has pointed this out, that we are going to have a terrific residual civil service to manage these contracts, to respect the competitive process, to maintain and keep corruption out of them. And in some respects, elevating the residual civil service is going to be a prerequisite to making this thing work.
It better be better than ever to keep tabs on all this. Steve, that's just terrific, and I want to thank you for your call. We have so many who want to join us. I want to move to Karen calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that we have just managed with great difficulty to get rid of contract workers in the airports so that we could federalize the workers to have some efficiency there.
Isn't that the truth? Just in the last couple of days, and it's been celebrated all around.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is ridiculous. And look how many mistakes and how many errors they had to make before we could get rid of these contractors. Once they get in there, you can't get them out. And I'm a federal worker. I've seen contracts that the money wasn't appropriated to fulfill a contract till after the need for the project was over. And even though we didn't need the building anymore, this contracted company had the contract, so they had to build it.
So just going private doesn't guarantee anything like heaven. Karen, thank you for your call. Adrian Moore, what about that? It's a little ironic that within days we have these two moves. The security people at the airports going federal, and Bush pushing hundreds of thousands of other federal employees toward the private sector.
Well, yeah, we have to keep in mind what we're comparing here. I mean, the last caller had the example of the contractor being paid for a building that the government wasn't using anymore. But think of how many stories you've heard about employees who don't have a job anymore in the federal government continuing to be employed because you can't get rid of a function or employee or an agency even when it no longer has a reason to live. We still have a rural electrification service, for crying out loud. Its mission is to make sure we have electricity in the rural parts of the country.
And there are a lot of light bulbs out there.
We don't have any electricity here.
But what about this issue? If we decided as a country that we needed federal employees in the airports to get the job done right, why will private employees be better for so much of the rest of the federal government?
Well, it's what the goal is about. I mean, keep in mind a couple of things here. First of all, that the contractors that used to do aviation security worked for the airlines. And followed everything they did was a federal guideline process.
Okay.
So the federal government told them exactly what they could and could not do, and they did exactly that. And it used to be you get those people through quick, and that's it. The job is to move the people through and run them through a metal detector, and that's it. Don't mess with it otherwise. Well, it turned out we had a disaster, which wasn't caused by aviation security at all because box cutters were legal. And so nothing went wrong with the security system at all. What was wrong was our standard of what was safety versus convenience. We changed our minds at that, and it seemed like the logical way to implement that.
And yet we just note that when the chips were down, we went to federal employees. Jason Peckinpah, what's your sense sitting in Washington of how this is going to change the face of the federal government over the next decade?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, we had the call from Steve, the Clinton administration official, mm-hmm. Who talked about their own efforts, you know, to kind of downsize the government. And you know, one of the big legacies of that downsizing effort was what a lot of folks, including the Comptroller General, refer to as the human capital crisis in the federal government. Basically, a big portion of federal employees are projected to retire within the next 5 years, in part because so many folks were made to leave the government under the Clinton administration. The point just being, not that that's good or bad, but the point just being, it's difficult to say what the long-term effect of this policy will be.
Except Jackie Simon gives us an important marker here. It's a one-way street. Once you privatize, it's very hard to go back.
I'd like to say something else about that with regard to the airport screeners.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tremendous amount of scrutiny of the federal workforce. We know exactly how many there are. We know what they do. We know what they're paid. We know quite a lot about the federal workforce. But as Paul Light probably described, because he wrote a whole book about it, we know virtually nothing about the contractor workforce. But the one time...
In terms of security knowledge, let's
say. No, I'm just meaning in terms of the size, the cost, and what they do, and how well they do it.
You just got 10 seconds, Jackie.
The one time there was a lot of federal scrutiny about what a contractor workforce was up to, we decided to nationalize the industry.
Well, there we go. With that, we're going to have to let it go. I want to thank all of you for a really interesting conversation. Jackie Simon, thanks so much for coming on tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie Simon is Public Policy Director for the American Federation of Government Employees. And Adrian Moore in Los Angeles, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Adrian Moore is Vice President of Research at the Reason Foundation. And Jason Peckinpah, great to have you. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Jason Peckinpah is a reporter for the Government Executive. He joined us tonight from Washington, D.C. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a look at the effort to clean up the massive oil spill off the coast of Spain. This is On Point. Strong winds and choppy seas are hampering efforts to clean up a major oil spill off the coast of Spain. The crippled tanker Prestige sank yesterday as it was being towed away from shore. About 3 million of its 20 million gallons have leaked out into the ocean. And the traditional cleanup techniques of skimming, burning, and dissipating the tarry goo will be difficult in the deep waters of the Atlantic. David Kennedy, the director of the National Ocean Service's Office of Response and Restoration, has worked on several big oil spills, including the Exxon Valdez. In this radio diary, he says most of the cleanup will have to be done when the oil comes to shore.
People in rubber suits with shovels and rakes, scraping, collecting into buckets, buckets into barrels, and barrels into containment dikes that are put at strategic locations on the backsides of the beaches or just off the beach. One of the significant problems is, especially with a thick, viscous oil like this, if you try and collect it with anything other than kind of the delicate, if you will, manual approach with shovels and rakes, front-end loaders begin to scrape way too much sand and or other material up with the oil. One, that's valuable material that, that kind of keeps the beach intact and creates a living environment. But two, that kind of volume beyond the oil having picked up all becomes a very, very huge disposal issue. And so quite often in the end, you need the human touch to just remove the oil and not lots of other material with it. Working on an oil spill is similar in some respects to some of the pictures that I saw during the 9/11 Trade Tower issue. Obviously not as dire, and you don't have human life at stake, but you have extremely dedicated people who are working 18 to 20 hours a day that have a true national crisis on their hands. They're sitting and watching, in most cases, an extremely beautiful environmental coast be contaminated, and with all the implications of that contamination, not only the black oil on the shore itself, but the wildlife that is washing up that's dead. The smell itself is quite often overpowering. You have so many lives that are disrupted. You have all of the folks in the villages and communities of the area who quite often rush down to volunteer to help save the birds, to actually go out and scoop the oil up in buckets themselves. But all of their lives, horribly disrupted, just a crisis atmosphere. There is just an intensity and a sense of purpose and mission that you see and feel, and a drive and a desire to do everything in your power to try and stop what's going on from impacting any more than it already is. The Exxon Valdez, even 13 years later, casts a very, very long shadow to this day in so many ways. One, there is still oil in Prince William Sound. Researchers can go up to this day, especially those that are familiar with where some of the real problem areas were, and dig down through the sand and gravel and pull up oil that smells almost as fresh as the day that it was first deposited on that beach, which is just incredible to me. I never anticipated that might happen. Those are relatively small areas. If you looked at Prince William Sound, in many cases, you would be hard-pressed to see much of any difference, but it's there. The oil is still there. There are still some impacts that are being studied that we don't yet completely understand. But the Exxon also casts a long shadow, I think, in people's conscience. Any place that I go, you can mention Exxon Valdez and get kind of a very visceral response still from most anybody that knew or knows or even read about that spill. So, like I said, it's cast a very long shadow, I think, in the conscience of the United States and how we view pollution.
David Kennedy is the director of the National Ocean Service's Office of Response and Restoration. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.